From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a former Army captain reflects on his experiences at the age of 23, leading a platoon of 18-year-old Rangers in Afghanistan, clearing caves and searching for members of Al-Qaeda. Andrew Exum has written a new memoir called This Man's Army, a soldier story from the front lines of the war on terrorism. Also, how security problems have affected the process of democratization in Iraq. We talk with Larry Diamond. He's the coordinator of the Democracy Program at Stanford University's Institute for International Studies. Diamond spent the first 3 months of this year in Iraq advising the Coalition Provisional Authority. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Former Enron CEO Kenneth Lay has been indicted on criminal charges. Lay issued a statement today saying that he'd been indicted and that he would surrender to authorities tomorrow. He said that he had done nothing wrong and that the indictment was not justified. NPR's Wade Goodwin reports.
For the last 2 weeks, the rumors in Houston have been flying that the Enron task force was going to take down Ken Lay and do it soon. Lay was once a hero among Houston's elite, but he has now joined 23 of his colleagues in facing federal criminal counts. He is likely to face charges of fraud. For the last several weeks, a Houston grand jury has heard testimony that was focused on the warnings Lay received about the company's precarious financial position 3 months before the collapse. Subsequent statements by Lay to investors and shareholders about Enron's bright financial prospects are likely to be the focus of prosecutors. Wade Goodwin, NPR News.
The State Department says a U.S. Marine who disappeared in Iraq is alive. A State Department official say Corporal Wasef Ali Hassoun has been in contact with the U.S. Embassy in Beirut. Hassoun is believed to be in Lebanon, but officials say they don't know his whereabouts. Hassoun was reported missing on June 20th. A week later, he appeared on a television broadcast blindfolded and surrounded by gunmen who threatened to kill him. The group later said that it released Hassoun after he promised not to return to the U.S. military. The Iraqi government has announced security laws to help control the danger from insurgents. They include a provision allowing interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi to impose martial law. NPR's Philip Reeves has more from Baghdad.
The new security laws introduced by the new interim Iraqi government allow for a state of emergency to be declared in areas where there is trouble with the insurgency. This would allow officials in certain circumstances to intercept mail and telephone calls, to arrest suspects, to freeze assets of people who are suspected of involvement in the insurgency, to seal off certain areas, to close businesses, and to ban people from traveling or from holding gatherings. The law also provides for curfews and extra searches and for checkpoints, although many Iraqis, most Iraqis in Baghdad, for example, have been familiar with those kind of conditions for many months.
NPR's Philip Reeves. The Pentagon says prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, will be notified within 10 days that they have a right to challenge their detentions in U.S. courts. Defense officials say that panels of military officers will review whether the prisoners are being held legally. The announcement came after the Supreme Court ruled that foreign prisoners held at the prison camp came under the jurisdiction of U.S. courts. In stocks, the Dow gained 21 points to close at 10,240 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq was up 2 to 1966. This is NPR News. The UN Relief Coordinator for Sudan says that non-governmental aid groups for the first time are starting to get access to more than 1 million people who've fled their homes in the western Darfur region. But he warns that the humanitarian crisis is urgent and time is running out. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
Jan Egelaan briefed the UN Security Council upon his return over the weekend from a trip to the Darfur region. He says that aid is starting to reach the displaced people of Darfur, who are living in 137 camps inside Sudan. According to UN officials, the government of Sudan previously had denied aid groups access to the camps. The Sudanese government is accused of supporting Arab militias who've been attacking villages, mostly the homes of black Africans. The relief coordinator says because the UN has asked for $350 million in emergency aid for Darfur, but has received only about 40% of that amount. Eglon says that without more aid donations and the means to deliver it, meaning helicopters, planes, and trucks, hundreds of thousands are likely to die. Vicki O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
Firefighters say a wildfire has climbed to within a quarter mile of a mountaintop observatory in Arizona. The $200 million scientific site is under construction on Mount Graham, which is currently threatened by two fires that total about 22,000 acres. Fire officials say there's a good chance one of the fires will destroy structures in two small communities on the mountain. Firefighters are drenching some cabins with water in an effort to keep them from catching fire. So far, the fires are only about 10% contained. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR shop introduces the limited edition NPR Tivoli Model 1 radio, designed by Henry Kloss for both performance and simplicity, available at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Andrew Exum, is a former Army captain who completed his military service 2 months ago. At the age of 23, he led a platoon of Army Rangers in Afghanistan, clearing caves and searching for members of Al-Qaeda. He was also deployed to Kuwait and was part of a classified special operations mission in Iraq. Exum has written a new memoir called This Man's Army, a soldier's story from the front lines of the war on terrorism. Now, you joined ROTC at the University of Pennsylvania because he gave you a scholarship. And you didn't have enough money, in spite of having worked for several years, you know, to pay for your tuition at Penn. Would you have otherwise enlisted?
I think so. I am from the volunteer state, and I also grew up in East Tennessee and in the city of Chattanooga. And I don't think, if you haven't been there, you didn't grow up there, it's tough to really imagine what it's like growing up in that city with the markers from the Civil War just on all the high ground, the cannons, the monuments. And you just get that sense, that feeling that, when you, as a young man, when you come of age, when you become, a young man of the age of 18, 19, 20, it's just your duty to serve in the military. And a couple things kind of exacerbated that sense of service. The first was the fact that my grandfather and his service in World War II always loomed very large on my conscience. I grew up with his medals hanging above me in and my bedroom. And the second thing had to have been my classical education. I mean, you read about the ancient, ancient polis of Athens or Sparta, and something that went hand in hand with citizenship was service in the military. You couldn't be a real citizen unless you served in the military. It's worth noting you couldn't be a citizen if you weren't male, also. But I do believe in that young men and young women, do owe service to their country, especially while they're young and they can do things that we can't do when we become older.
You flew with your men into Afghanistan. Would you describe the plane and the mood on the plane?
Yeah, well, before I describe that mood, you have to understand what our previous 5.5 months had been like. We deployed right after September 11th as part of the first conventional forces to deploy. And after September 11th, we weren't sure if there were going to be more attacks in the United States, if there were going to be more attacks in the Middle East. So we went to Kuwait and beefed up the security of one of the bases there. And there we pretty much sat for 5.5 months. And we did some convoy escort missions, but we pretty much watched the war in Afghanistan on Fox and CNN just like the rest of America. Whatever Armed Forces Network showed us about the war, that's what we saw. And it was incredibly frustrating. So when the U.S. and the coalition planners were really hurt for ground troops in the battle, what they called Operation Anaconda, the battle for the Shaikat Valley, we were called up and sent from Kuwait, and the mood on the plane was just exuberant. These guys, it was like they'd been released from prison, and the fact that we were ending what we thought was going to be our deployment, and then to be asked to actually do what we thought we were going to do in the first place. We descended into Bagram Airfield in eastern Afghanistan at night, and there were no lights. I mean, there was no ambient light, no moon. It was about as pitch black as you can imagine, with the exception of a few of the lights coming from, you know, the control tower and the runway. And they kept it pitch black because there were still attacks on the planes that were coming in, you know, still rockets that were fired at the cargo planes, and that's why they only flew at night as well. But when we woke up that morning, I was just struck by the sheer beauty of what we just descended into. We were in the Panjshir Valley in eastern Afghanistan, and really the foothills of the Himalayas, and the view was, you know, quite simply breathtaking. And it was hard to match up that breathtaking view with what we were going to be asked to do, which was in effect a pretty grim task.
Now, there's a moment in your memoir where you describe, I think it was nighttime, and, you know, you're sitting, I guess it was in the Panjshir Valley, you know, absolutely beautiful, surrounded by mountains, and a daisy cutter, one of the really big bombs, is dropped on one of the mountains, and what do you see?
Yeah, that was in the first night we landed in the Shaikot Valley. We were in the west on a train feature that they called the Whale. It looked like this feature at the National Training Center at Fort Irwin, California, that was also called the Whale, so they named it as such. And one of my squad leaders and I, we just settled into our position for the night, and it was getting dark, and we were looking across this massive valley towards where we knew some of the Al Qaeda positions were. And, you know, I can't even describe it. Quite literally, you know, we didn't hear an explosion. Obviously, you see the light before you hear anything. And we just saw just this massive red fireball, which is followed by, obviously, this giant mushroom cloud of smoke. And they dropped, you know, the Air Force had dropped some, I don't know, 5,000-pound bomb. And it literally masked an entire mountain, this giant mountain that had previously loomed large over the terrain. We couldn't even see the mountain anymore. I mean, our reaction was just so stunned. And, I describe in the book that we just started laughing, you know, laughing that because we'd never seen anything with that, you know, never, couldn't even comprehend that type of military might. And just, you know, out of joy that we weren't on the receiving end of that. Because after seeing the effects of the United States Air Force when it wants to, when it puts its mind to something, it is ugly, it is nasty, and the lives for those on the opposite end are painfully short.
Now, you killed a man during one of your searches. You saw him, shot him, and then after realizing he had a machine gun, released four more rounds, and two other soldiers fired at him too.
Yeah.
And you write in your memoir, "My thought was more amazement than horror. Actions unleashed by my hand had ended the life of this man. I couldn't believe it." Could you describe for us what happened that made it necessary for you to shoot?
Sure. Well, about a week prior, I'd seen my first freshly killed body in combat. One of the other platoons in my company had just killed this guy, and they were in a pretty large position. So I brought up a squad of my guys, and I turned a corner, and I see this enemy body that just looked inhuman. This enemy fighter's face was completely gone, and it was really, you know, shocking and horrifying. And it was probably more shocking than what I saw with the fighter that I myself killed. With that incident, I was patrolling with one squad, and I'd sent them to go clear an enemy bunker that I'd seen. And I'm watching this when my artillery sergeant, who travels with me, my forward observer, you know, from North Georgia, just across the border from where I grew up, you know, spots this enemy position behind us. And we had been clearing positions all afternoon, and I didn't think it was anything too serious. So I grabbed my radio operator and my machine gun team, and we walk up there. And we advanced pretty stealthily and pretty tactically, and my machine gunner Carl McCulley, who's carrying his pistol at that point, he sees this enemy fighter, and he says, "Sir, I see feet to the right, feet to the right," and I turn and pivot and fire two shots at these feet, and sure enough, the enemy fighter sat up, and I actually couldn't even see his machine gun, but Carl and I ended up killing this guy, and then we came over. And came over this rise in what was pretty restrictive terrain. We shot the guy from only about 10 meters away, and yet it took us a while to just get up to where he was because of the very rocky nature of things. And you know, you see this enemy soldier, or what you hope is an enemy soldier, living out his last moments on Earth. And it was shocking because the machine gun that I saw was an American-made machine gun.
The one that he had.
And he had all this, he had all this American equipment on him. And I tell people the only time I was really honestly petrified, the only time I was really scared was that moment. And as we searched him, we began to discover that American equipment he had on him was equipment that had been stolen from Americans in a fight about 2 weeks prior on a mountaintop called Taker Gar in the Shaikot Valley. And my heart rate began to fall a little bit. But at the same time, this enemy fighter was still twitching out his last moments on Earth. I mean, there was nothing we could have done to save him. He was shot multiple times. But at the same time, the juxtaposition between that incident and the incident a week prior is that now I was watching, what was very human, what I could relate to, because I was watching someone in the last moments of their life. And it was much more different.
I mean, compared to watching the daisy cutter on the mountain.
Well, right, than that, or then seeing this lifeless body that no longer had a face, that looked inhuman.
Right.
At once the inhuman and the surreal, became very real and very human.
You were later interviewed by an Army major about the shooting. Your explanation is that a national reporter had observed it, and the military was concerned about how the reporter would interpret the shooting. And, would the reporter think that you used excess force?
Yeah.
And you write, whoever heard of excess violence in a war? How could a general who dropped 10,000-pound bombs on enemy soldiers accuse you of being excessive because you fired half a magazine of ammunition at an enemy soldier? Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, we had a reporter from the Army Times, which is an independent magazine or independent weekly magazine that focuses on Army issues, a guy by the name of Sean Naylor, who I've stayed in touch with. And he was traveling with my platoon at the time. This was before the Army began its embedded reporter program, and had, before it really started to train reporters on, what they might see on the battlefield. So they were somewhat worried that, he'd be taken aback by the fact that we fired so many shots. And, my battalion commander later saw the scene of where it took place. And, he told me, he said, first off, judging from the terrain, the fact that the enemy fighter was partially obscured, is in very difficult, rocky terrain. He was in a dug-in position. He didn't have any problem with the fact that we fired so many rounds. And it just made sense as far as the terrain. It made sense for, two soldiers in their first real engagement with an enemy soldier. But at the same time, I guess someone was a little nervous that we'd be portrayed poorly. And, of course, that wasn't the case. Sean Naylor wrote a great piece on my platoon for the Army Times and made both myself and Specialist McCulley look really good. But at the same time, there's definitely that nervousness. And I talk about in the book about how, this is a professional Army, and that's great in so many ways, because we have an Army that really studies tactics. We have officers that make a lifetime study of war and warfare and how to keep soldiers alive and how to, how to win battles effectively. But at the same time, you've also got a lot of very image conscious officers, and they want things to be reported in a way that makes the unit and themselves look good. So I was frustrated at that whole process, and my company commander, God bless him, he was frustrated right there along with me. And yes, ma'am, go ahead.
Can you talk a little bit about trying to weigh what excessive force means in a war where 10,000-pound bombs are being dropped?
Right. Yeah, it's tough because it's how do you where is that moral calculus? Where is that what is deemed excessive? What is deemed what is deemed sane? Really kind of the rules go out the window, and it I think it's easy somewhat to drop 10,000-pound bombs because you you really don't see what happens on the working end of those bombs. You know, nobody's down there recording what happened. They may give a battle damage assessment, but it's not the same as shooting someone and then watching that person die in front of you. That seems to make a very much more real portrayal of war.
My guest is former Army Captain Andrew Exum. His new memoir is called This Man's Army, A Soldier Story from the Front Lines of the War on Terrorism. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Andrew Exum, and his memoir, This Man's Army, is about his experiences leading an infantry platoon in Afghanistan and Kuwait. We talked a little bit about what it was like for you when you shot an enemy soldier in Afghanistan. I'm interested in hearing what it was like for you when the men you led in the platoon were injured. The first casualty in your platoon was a young man who threw a grenade into a cave, and the shrapnel wounded him. How bad was that wound?
Well, it was a lot worse when we first saw it. when I came upon the scene, you know, he was sitting there bleeding profusely from his elbow, and I saw two of my other soldiers rapidly trying to staunch this bleeding, and that is certainly something that it happened probably an hour after we killed that enemy fighter. And so, that's two cold cups of coffee right there. That's two wake up calls as to the realities of war. And that was definitely something that caused my heart to skip a few beats until we got the bleeding stopped.
Yeah, as the platoon leader, what is your feeling of responsibility when one of your men is injured? Like what's within your ability to actually do?
It's a feeling of intense responsibility. I remember, going into our first mission in Afghanistan and seeing kind of the looks of fear on some of my soldiers' faces, and then looking at my platoon sergeant, and he looked back at me, and I could tell what he was thinking. We both, our thoughts were not with ourselves. It was with the 34 men that we were entrusted with to take to war, to do a mission, and then to bring home. And there's a British writer, Jeffrey Powell, who led British paratroopers at Operation Market Garden at Arnhem and World War II. And he writes this in his book, Men at Arnhem. He writes about how leaders actually get killed on the battlefield, and it's not by doing anything heroic. It's not by charging any machine gun position single-handedly. It's usually just by doing their jobs, and that's the problem with leaders, is that their obligation to their men and to their mission is so intense that they forget to be scared. I would say that your fear is not so much that something's going to happen to you, but that something's going to happen to your men. And that's certainly something that I think weighs on all combat leaders.
Did you forget to be scared?
Yeah. Yeah, in several cases, on several occasions. I think there are, I talk about in the book, there were a couple times which I look back and I'm just like, man, that was stupid. I didn't have to take that risk.
One of those risks that in retrospect you think was stupid and unnecessary?
Right. One of the things that I write about in the book was one of my squad leaders and I went back into a small little valley, kind of a large gully in a larger valley in which we'd just blown two ammunition caches with plastic explosives, and there were secondary explosions going off. There were small arms rounds that were flying through the valley. There were bullets that were basically burning and then exploding as they burned. Same thing with rockets. And we had neglected to detonate two landmines that were in the middle of this this kind of trail leading up a valley. And so we went back, and instead of waiting, you know, prudentially waiting for, you know, a day or so before the explosions died down, the two of us with plastic explosives, you know, draped around our necks, ran back into this valley. And as literally bullets were going above our heads, we, you know, we sat there, you know, putting these explosives on top of these two landmines. And I tell you, there's not much that's more harrowing than trying to rig plastic explosives on a landmine as things are exploding above your head, because you never know, you know, if that's the landmine exploding or if that's the if that's just something above your head. So, and to keep ourselves off balance, we kept joking back and forth to one another about how stupid it was that we were doing it. And then it was that night, you know, when we kind of settled down for the night, that we were talking together, and we were just like, man, that really was stupid. And I think, you know, our eagerness to do the right thing and to, you know, get those two mines taken care of, outstripped our common sense. But that's the story of my life. my courage or stupidity outstripping my common sense. So I guess that's consistent with everything else I've done.
Andrew Exum's new memoir is called This Man's Army, a soldier story from the front lines of the war on terrorism. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with Larry Diamond about the process of democratization in Iraq. He's the coordinator of the Democracy Program at Stanford University's Institute for International Studies and work with the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq. Also, we continue our conversation with former Army Captain Andrew Exum. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with former Army Captain Andrew Exum. He led a platoon of Army Rangers in Afghanistan, clearing caves and searching for members of Al-Qaeda. His new memoir is called This Man's Army. He says that some men in his platoon were born trigger pullers, but many of the men were raised on PlayStation, and they had to be taught to be physically aggressive and fight.
One of my old football coaches at Penn, he one time told me, he asked me, because he knew I was in ROTC, he said, Exum, do you know why we won World War II? I said, no, coach, I don't know why we won World War II. And he said, because we were a nation of football players playing a nation full of soccer players. And, and you know, I kind of laughed at that. And, I said, well, coach, wait a minute, what about, you know, didn't the British invent soccer? And he said, shut up, Exum. And, but, you know, it still stayed with me that, you know, I think something like 90% of the soldiers in World War II played high school football and, you know, grew up being aggressive. You know, now I had a couple football players and you know, a couple athletes in my platoon, but I also had a lot of kids that you know, just grew up playing video games or goofing off or kind of being adrift and then joined the Army. And so, yeah, it's like I write in the book, it is tough, you know, training those kids raised on PlayStation to, you know, actually, you know, be physical and you know, be, you know, like my high school football coaches used to tell me, you know, play with controlled violence, controlled fury. You know, growing up playing football as a 105-pound free safety in East Tennessee, I learned how to be aggressive and how to take my licks. So, but that's something that a lot of people going into the Army did not learn.
Some of the men in your platoon had stress-related problems, particularly as time went on.
Yeah.
One of them had a nervous breakdown. You said, you know, like if a man was crying or something, you said you had no sympathy. You called these men effing pansies.
Yeah.
Why no sympathy for them?
Yeah, and that's well, first off, because I was immature, and yeah, I never said that to their faces, but you know, my company commander caught me muttering that under my breath one time. And he said, you know, you can't judge how other people are going to handle the stresses of combat. You know how you're going to handle it. And you hope that you're going to be as brave as you want yourself to be. But ultimately, you know, you don't know what's going on in other people's heads. And that was a lesson that I had to learn. And you know, I recall, you know, one of the guys in my platoon breaking down, crying on you know, the second night of a 4-day patrol, and it you know, my platoon sergeant wisely kept it from me and didn't mention it, and kind of, you know, swept it under the rug, and we left that guy back on our next mission. But it would have made me incredibly angry, because here you are, you know, it'd be one thing if it's just you know, if the war is just about your war and just about your fight. However, you know, there are 33 other guys that are counting on you to make the right decisions, that are counting on you to, you know, to be brave, that are counting on you to pull your share. And you're not only endangering your own life, you're endangering their lives. And that's something that I still feel. I read about, you know, reading a lot of the defenses of the deserter, or I believe it's Carmelo Mejia, Sergeant Mejia, who was sentenced for desertion. When he came back home from Iraq and refused to go back. You know, reading a lot of the apologies for him and a lot of the defenses, you know, I remember reading Bob Herbert's column in the New York Times. I wanted to scream aloud at the op-ed page, look, you just don't get it. It's one thing if you're just an individual guy and just an independent operator out there, but, you know, a guy like Sergeant Mejia, he had 9 guys counting on him to keep them safe in, you know, in the town of Ramadi. And so, you know, ultimately, you know, warfare and soldiers, what makes them special is, I mean, they're not any better than normal Americans. There's nothing about them that's inherently more honorable, except for one thing, and that's that they make a decision to give themselves and to sacrifice and to serve. And you know, when you abandon that service, when you abandon that commitment that you've made to your fellow soldiers, you know, I don't think there's anything worse. Now, when we got back, then it changed a little bit. Then when guys started having issues of post-traumatic stress, and you've really got to give them the benefit of the doubt, because, you know, it's like my company commander told me, you don't know what's going on in that guy's mind. Just because you handled everything okay, and just because you were able to process everything you had to do, doesn't mean that they were able to.
You are no longer in the military.
Right.
But some of the men who were in your platoon are in the military, and several of them are being affected by the new stop-loss policy, which allows commanders to hold soldiers past the date that they're due to leave service if their unit is scheduled to be deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan.
Sure.
Have you heard from any of those men?
Yeah, I sure have. I got involved with the stop-loss policy in my last days in the Army, and I got, the calls from my guys and my platoon, the old platoon of the 10th Mountain Division. I'd ceased to be their platoon leader something like 2 years, 2 years ago, but those guys still stay in regular touch with me. And, a couple of them called to say, hey, we're going to Iraq. We just got our deployment orders. And then the second thing they said was, but I don't know how we're going to go because, a quarter of our company is supposed to get out of the Army this summer. And a couple of days later, then they found out how they were all getting stop-lost. And my old radio operator, who's closest thing I have to a little brother, was supposed to go back to San Francisco and got stop-lost. And, that is something that is inherently legal. The Army has the right to do that. It's in the contract. But at the same time, it made me mad because I felt like one of the reasons we were stop-lossing soldiers was to avoid having a much more difficult discussion, which was whether our Army is really up to the long-term foreign policy commitments we have in both Iraq and Afghanistan, not to mention all the other places that soldiers are deployed in the world. And I think that stop-loss policy, when combined with the activation of the individual ready reserve, in other words, bringing soldiers back onto active duty who have already been honorably discharged, I think that's a pretty clear sign that the military is unable to meet those needs. So I ended up writing a op-ed piece in the New York Times and speaking out, trying to affect some change, but unfortunately it didn't help, and all my old soldiers are over in Iraq right now.
What's your status?
I'm still actually on the individual ready reserve, so I guess I could get called up at any time if the Army grows weary of my protests. But we'll see. I've got a pretty banged up knee, so I'm not sure I could pass the physical. But if I did, and they called me back up, I mean it's part of my duty. If the military calls me, if I don't care if I'm 55 years old and can barely walk, if the military says they need me, I'll be there.
Well, you mentioned your knee. You had a really bad knee injury, not in the war, but playing street hockey in the United States, when a lieutenant fell on your foot, and that popped your knee, and you blew a tendon and
broke
a bone.
Split my tibia in half, and it's nasty.
So, I mean, how ironic is that? You survive Afghanistan, and then you come home, and you get this really bad injury in street hockey.
Yeah, right.
When somebody falls on you.
and what made it even more painful is because people told me the exact same thing that you just said. As I'm sitting there bedridden, angry because I'm not going into the big invasion of Iraq. I later served, but I'm all angry because I'm not deploying with my platoon over there. People were like, "Ah, wow, how ironic it is." You made it all the way back from Afghanistan, didn't get hurt, and now you blew your knee out and you're all messed up. And I say, "Yeah, thanks. That's not helping." But the good news was that it did give me the opportunity to write this book, and that's when I really started. I really sat down and started writing about my platoon in the 10th Mountain Division, because you got to keep in mind, in January of 2003, our nation was not focused on Afghanistan. We were focused on Iraq already. And I began to worry that, my soldiers' contributions had really kind of been forgotten. So the knee injury ended up being a blessing in disguise, although, I loved running and I can't run anymore. But, it did give me the time to settle down and write this book.
So what do you plan for the next phase of your life?
Well, I'm on a book tour right now. And then in September, my plan is to head off to the American University in Beirut, where I'll study English Lit and learn Arabic and work on a new book. I'm looking to do a study of Arab youth culture. And so that will take up the next couple of years as I'm compiling interviews and, trying to understand, attitudes about America, about the world from an Arab perspective.
Well, Captain Exum, thank you so much for talking with us.
Yeah, no, it was really my privilege.
Andrew Exum's new memoir is called This Man's Army. Coming up, how security problems are affecting the democratization of Iraq. This is Fresh Air. ¶¶ Now that Iraq has regained sovereignty, it still has a way to go before becoming a democracy. My guest, Larry Diamond, is the coordinator of the Democracy Program at Stanford University's Institute for International Studies. He's also a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. He spent much of the first 3 months of this year in Iraq advising the Coalition Provisional Authority. The handover of sovereignty caught everyone by surprise when it took place 2 days before it was planned, avoiding terrorist attacks that may have been timed to coincide with the event. I asked Diamond what he thought of the early handover.
I think it was a brilliant maneuver. You know, the terrorists are constantly taking us by surprise. I think we saw with this shrewd and adept decision, partly driven by concerns on the part of the CPA, our occupation administration, and part by a request from Prime Minister Alawi, we saw the beginning of adaptability on the part of ourselves in kind of outmaneuvering the terrorists. It was a good decision, and probably it was not the time for a grand celebration in any case.
What are the documents that are now governing Iraq and saying what the laws are?
Well, there are several sets of documents. The most important, of course, is the highest one, which is their interim constitution. It's called the Transitional Administrative Law. It was drafted over a period of a few months between December and the end of February. But then there are a number of orders and regulations that were issued by our administrator, L. Paul Bremer III, over the course of the occupation. And those have, for the time being, again, in theory, the force of law.
You've described the Transitional Administrative Law as the most liberal and progressive basic governance document anywhere in the Arab world. What are some of the best parts of this?
Well, I'd like to mention three. First of all, there is a Bill of Rights, a very detailed and encompassing set of guarantees of individual liberties that draw heavily from the principles in our own Bill of Rights, but more importantly in terms of legitimacy in the Arab world, from the Universal Declaration on Human Rights and the International Covenant on Political and Civil Liberties. These guarantee freedom of religion, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, due process of law, in very great detail. Secondly, and very importantly in terms of ensuring political stability in the country, the Transitional Administrative Law provides for, in essence, a federal system with some significant delegation of authority down to the level of provinces, which are like our states in a way. There are 18 of them in Iraq. This gives the Kurds, who have a level of government between the provinces in the center called a regional government, and it has retained in this document most of the powers and rights and responsibilities that it has exercised over the last 12 years. This gives the Kurds some security, some sense of dignity, some confidence that their rights and their very lives are not going to be trampled on as they were under Saddam. Third, there is a provision, which some people in the CPA were initially not happy about, but understood the importance of, that guarantees that 25% of all the seats in the national parliament will be held by women. And I think this is a very important principle to establish in an emerging democracy.
How concerned are you about the role of Islam in the new government of Iraq after the transitional period is over?
Well, it could still be a democracy. It just might not be a very liberal one. I personally think, having traveled around the country and studied its politics a little bit, that if there is a free and fair election in Iraq, Iraqis are not going to vote for a strongly, militantly Islamist government. My concern, and this now gets us into the politics of the situation, is that there won't be a free and fair election, that the Shiite Islamist parties have gotten so much money from Iran have built up their militias to such a powerful degree. There's money pouring in from Saudi Arabia for the Sunni Islamist parties with Wahhabist influence. My concern is that unless the international community in its support role and its mediating role take fairly energetic steps to level the political playing field, to ensure some base of political funding for all political parties, and to make sure that the leading parties are not able to use their militias to intimidate voters, assassinate opponents, and intimidate electoral officials by way of rigging elections, that we could see the real level of support for Islamist parties in Iraq inflated considerably by undemocratic means.
Now, you advised the Coalition Provisional Authority for 3 months, from January through March of 2004. And I believe you were asked to do that by Condoleezza Rice and by Paul Bremer, who was the head of the CPA. Was this the first time that you've put theory into practice and you've actually worked within a country that is in the process of becoming a democracy?
It's the first time I've done it in such an intensive, full-time way, rather than just being in a place for a week or a few days.
Mm-hmm.
I've observed elections in a number of countries, but I've never been working on a transition in quite such a sustained way, particularly in a post-conflict setting.
So give us a good example of a theory you've always held dear, a principle you always held dear, that wasn't really working out that way in Iraq. You know, where the theory didn't fit the reality?
Well, one example that I give people, because most of the theories actually, I think, proved to have some resilience in the face of the crucible of Iraqi politics and violent conflict. But we think that it's a wonderful thing to recruit people to be involved in politics, that we go around and give them courses and training, expose them to different ideas and models, and then they kind of go out and remake their political system. And I remember meeting with the Iraqi Higher Women's Council, and one of the members of the council, who in fact was also a member of the Iraqi Governing Council, got up and said to me, what is the relationship between personal security and the overall political process in the country? And I wasn't quite sure of what she meant. And then, you know, I asked her, and she said, who's going to protect us if we run for office, as you say? If we become involved in politics, who's going to keep us alive? And I had seen the links between personal security and the unfolding political transition hit me more and more over a period of time, but this hit me squarely between the eyes because I realized that these women were really vulnerable. And indeed, one member of the Iraqi Governing Council had already been assassinated, and this woman suffered an assassination attempt some months later after our meeting in which her son was killed. And this brought home to me in a very personal way the dangers that Iraqis face in trying to rebuild their country and take control over their own politics, and the responsibility we have had, which I think to some considerable extent we have failed on, to provide the climate of security that could enable them to really achieve this goal.
Where do you think we went wrong in providing security in Iraq?
We didn't put in nearly enough troops from the beginning. I think the administration was incredibly stubborn, arrogant, hubristic, willful in insisting that its original vision of a light footprint was going to be adequate. What they didn't understand is that the needs for security in the country after Saddam fell would actually require many more troops than it would take to topple his regime. You know, we've just under-resourced the mission dramatically.
My guest is Larry Diamond, the coordinator of the Democracy Program at Stanford University's Institute for International Studies. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Larry Diamond, and he's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He's also a professor of political science at Stanford and coordinator of the Democracy Program at Stanford's Institute for International Studies. A lot of the security and a lot of the rebuilding of the infrastructure was contracted to private companies like, you know, Halliburton, Bechtel. Do you think that from the military's point of view and from the CPA's point of view, it worked to outsource so much of that to private contractors?
Let me make some distinctions, Terry. On the construction side, I think we should have done much more through Iraqi companies. I think it was a strategic mistake to put so much money in the hands of a few big external, in this case primarily American, contractors. I saw instances at a kind of local level where building had happened very rapidly by American CPA officials basically paying cash to local Iraqi contractors and giving them incentive bonuses for finishing the job early. A whole complex of democracy training buildings in Hilla got built in a matter of 2 or 3 months. A beautiful training center with, computer stations and 18 different offices, a men's and women's dormitory to house people who'd come to this regional training center, an auditorium. All of this went up in a matter of 3 months by a very different method of contracting. I think there should have been more of that. On the other hand, security was an enormous problem. The only way that people could be safe was essentially by having bodyguards. And having been guarded during my travels by Blackwater private security guards, I am not going to knock this company. I think they were enormously professional and effective in the job they did.
Earlier you said that you think one of the greatest problems that you came upon during the months that you worked in Iraq was the lack of security. And like a woman came up to you and said, yeah, democracy sounds great, but who's going to protect us if we run for office or get involved in politics? That there just wasn't enough security to make an open society possible.
I have written and said repeatedly it was the single biggest obstacle to rebuilding the country politically and economically that dwarfed everything else. We had the people in place. We had the money, $18.6 billion for economic and political reconstruction and support for civil society. We've spent only a tiny fraction of it so far because of the security situation.
Would you explain that to me? How much have we actually spent of the money?
By one account, I've read less than $500 million.
So what's happening to that money and why hasn't it been spent?
A lot of it is still there to be spent by the new United States Embassy, mm-hmm. the U.S. Agency for International Development, and so on. There was an allocation of funding to the National Endowment for Democracy, and it has made some grants, and it's ready to make more. But, you know, the problem has been that we haven't had sufficient security to actually dispense the money, to actually do the economic reconstruction projects. And much more of the money than we had anticipated had to be spent on hiring basically private security guards.
I don't know how honest you feel you can be about this, but when you were in Iraq working with the Coalition Provisional Authority and also, you know, interacting with the military, did you get the impression that people in the CPA and the military thought that in retrospect, you know, invading a country to help move it toward democracy was a kind of viable model?
Well, I was against the invasion, as you know, but what I found primarily in Iraq among the political officers I was working with, and in fact, most people within the CPA, were proud of what we'd done. And they were proud because they were working with Iraqis who were so grateful to be rid of Saddam. I encountered so many personal stories, emotionally told, to the point of people breaking out spontaneously in tears about the terror they felt, the fear they felt, the lives they lost of family members dear to them. And, you know, when you hear these stories and you see the mass graves, it's impossible not to feel that we did something right and good in toppling Saddam.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome. It's been a great pleasure, Terry.
Larry Diamond is the coordinator of the Democracy Program at Stanford University's Institute for International Studies, and he's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Ferriby is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dial Press, publisher of The Rule of Four, a debut suspense novel of the puzzling connection between an ancient manuscript and an Ivy League murder by Ian Caldwell and Dustin Thomason. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how the news is covered in the Middle East. We talk with the producers of Mosaic, a daily compilation of TV news reports from more than 15 countries, including Egypt, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. Also, Adam McKay. He directed and co-wrote the new film comedy Anchorman, starring Will Ferrell. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.